Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
I've always said about my writing that all I'm trying to be is half as funny as my best friends are two drinks down at 10 o'clock in the evening. And one of the things about clusters of friends doing, and I'm so glad you felt part of it, doing comedy, is you're actually reproducing the joys, in-jokes, silliness, fun, and imagination of friendship.
Hello and welcome to Cunning Cast with me, Tony Robinson. Today, I'm delighted to bring you another episode of Cunning Cast dedicated to the Lost Blackadder pilot. Blackadder is the iconic TV show I made my name on, playing the dim-witted Baldric, and last year it celebrated its 40th birthday. This interview was recorded for a TV show I made to celebrate 40 years of Blackadder. The TV show is called Blackadder the Lost Pilot, and it's available to watch on Sky, Virgin and Now. For the show, I interviewed many of my old friends, people who were central to making Blackadder the success it was. And it being television, we only used about 3 minutes of each interview, which actually went on for about an hour. One of these interviews was with the talented Mr. Richard Curtis, who was Blackadder's mastermind and writer alongside Ben Elton. And today I'm delighted to bring you a very special episode of Cunning Cast featuring my unedited behind-the-scenes chat with Richard Curtis.
You work on a lot of things, and sometimes some of them turn out to be magical. When we made Four Weddings, I promise you, the day it was released, we thought, if we're lucky, this movie around the world will make £5 million. We focused on a bit of work, and then the success is a magical piece of luck that sometimes happens. And I think about that with Blackadder.
I remember Richard as a bright young thing with blue glasses and red hair. He was the backbone of the show. He kept it going through thick and thin and 4 incredible series. After Blackadder, Richard went on to do great things in Hollywood. He's now known as one of Britain's most successful comedy screenwriters, with writing credits including Four Weddings and a Funeral, Notting Hill, Love Actually, it goes on and on, Bridget Jones' Diary, Yesterday. He's also the co-founder of Comic Relief, and he continues to raise millions for charitable causes each year. What a guy. Anyway, Melissa, my producer, is here to chat about my interview with Richard. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Tony. Well, I wanted to ask you about the setup for this interview. I wasn't there. I like to be there on your interviews, but these were not recorded by me. No. You recorded them with a TV crew. So set the scene for us. Where did you meet Richard?
So we went to Television Centre, which isn't a television production house anymore, at least not the bit that we went to. I think it's been
transformed into something like a Soho House Club. And I couldn't recognise the room I was in, even though I must have been in it loads and loads of time 40 years ago, because it had all been glammed up. But there was something nice about doing the interview there. It made it feel a bit real. Richard Slope's in, and it was just very matey. We are still friends, but we don't see each other very much, to be honest. We're usually in different continents. And there was that kind of smile on your faces when you know you're doing something a little bit conspiratorial and saying a few things you probably haven't said before, at least in public. And basically, we just enjoyed it. We knew that most of it wouldn't end up in the TV series, but it meant that we'd created a document which hopefully everyone will be able to share.
And on that note, you were desperate to put this into a podcast because you knew that conversation was full of gems. And it really is. I can't wait to play it to our audience. Before we do, I think we should give a tiny bit of context for people who don't know the story about the pilot to series one to series two. There's a really interesting format. Just quickly tell us what happened.
Rowan and Richard wrote a pilot for a new series after Rowan had left Not the 9 o'clock News. Richard took it back to England, tarted it up. They thought it was going to be absolutely fantastic. They got the money from the BBC. They cast it, including casting me in it, a young unknown. And then one day before the pilot was due to be recorded, bang, there was a strike at the BBC and it was stopped. And the strike went on so long, added pressure came on those studios and we weren't able to record it. About 4 or 5 months later, by that time, I'd gone to work at the National Theatre doing a Greek tragedy in a mask. And they called for me to come and do the pilot again. Wasn't available. So as far as I was concerned, that was it. Right. I wasn't going to be in this new series. ... That's where we begin this story.
Absolutely. And I think the pilot is very interesting because it's like series two in the format that you have a smart Blackadder and a really, you know, let's face it, dim-witted Baldric, of which you play when it comes to series one. But series one is not like that. There's a sort of interesting change that it goes through.
Yeah, there was always a debate about what the dynamic should be, whether you have a very strong, pushy, central character who's surrounded by total dimwits, or whether you have a dimwit central character who's kind of bailed out by his slightly less dim-witted colleagues. And it was a debate that ran through the series. And in the end, we went back to the initial thought, which is that at home, Blackadder is daft, but he wants to appear to be clever. The only way for that to happen is if he's surrounded by people who are even dafter than him, i.e. Baldric and Percy. And then when he goes into court, he thinks he's really great because all the discussions that he's had down in his kitchen make it seem like he's going to have the most wondrous, cunning plans ever. But when he gets to the court, each week he's thwarted.
I mean, it's such a good fact for real Blackadder fans. And I would urge everyone to go and watch the actual pilot. It is available now on Sky, Virgin and Now. Yeah. And it shows you that interesting dynamic. You see the beginnings of the Blackadder that I think that we really developed from series two. It's fascinating that.
That's true. And although there are some bits of it which are a bit turgid, there are actual parts of this pilot which I think are still comedy gold after all this time. I hope people enjoy it.
Matey!
Oh, my lord.
Hi.
Bloody hell, neither of us have changed.
Not remotely.
It could be 40 years ago. My hair was orange. Do you remember?
I had hair.
Yeah, you have bright orange hair and blue glasses.
You did, yes, you did.
It's incredible anyone ever took me seriously, and no woman ever did.
You were, when I met you, I suppose you were in your 27, 28, something like that?
I don't know. When is this incident we're talking about?
40 years ago.
40?
Yeah.
Okay, yes, I was, 26.
It's funny, isn't it? Because I think of you as one of my best mates, but actually, whole years go by, we don't see each other. There's so much I don't know about you.
Yeah, I'm very close to my grandmother, and she's been dead for 30 years. I mean, it's
a similar relationship.
It's the quality of the time, not the quantity of it.
When you were a very little boy, what sort of things made you laugh?
Gosh, very little.
Yeah.
I think it was mainly farting. I mean, I think that's basically all it was. We had this thing at school where if someone broke wind, you'd say slogs, and then slogs sixes, and then you're allowed to hit them. So whenever anybody broke wind, they had to say the word safeties, and that meant that if somebody hadn't got slogs in first, they weren't allowed to hit you. I think that kept me going for about 5 years, and then it was Monty Python.
Really? Was Monty Python the first comedy thing that made you...
absolutely obsessed us. A third of all conversation in my between 13 and 18 was people just repeating those words. You didn't have to think what you were going to say. Someone would say to you, it is an ex-parrot, and you would say, it's dead. You know, it was an obsessive passion.
And for me, being 10 years older than you, it was The Goon Show, exactly the same thing. Yeah. You'd just have to go, yeah, and everyone would know precisely what you meant.
Exactly.
It's weird that, isn't it? When you were at uni, did you start writing comedy straight away?
Well, it was a tragedy. I went to university convinced I would be an important, possibly the important actor of my generation. And then I auditioned and I auditioned and I auditioned. I got cast as third gentleman, second gentleman, not even Festy. What's the name of that total non-entity?
Fabian.
Fabian. I just couldn't get cast.
Yeah.
Because I obviously wasn't good at acting and I had a very bland face. And so I thought, how am I going to get on stage to prove my point? And the only thing I could do was write sketches. And then I met Rowan and suddenly I just hung on to his coattails for a decade.
And was it the sketches in Python that really excited you enough to make you want to write sketches?
Well, I suppose that was probably the format that I had in mind. But then, of course, there were lots of other, you know, good people who I knew about. Bob Newhart, and I loved Morecambe and Wise, and, you know, I loved the two Ronnies, I'm sure. So there was all sorts of other influences. And I don't think I was ever inclined to be as surreal as the Pythons were.
So more like Bob Newhart in a way.
Yeah, in a funny way. And then, of course, just meeting Rowan, then a whole new world of opportunities. I actually, as we say in Blackadder, I hated silent comedy. But Rowan, because he was so brilliant silently, we even started writing that stuff.
How did you meet him?
Whereas Cambridge had this whole system around the footlights, Oxford had no comedy structure. And an ad went up saying, if you want to take part in a comedy show, come to this professor's room. I walked into the room and there were like four human beings and a rather curious looking cushion. And it turned out after an hour that the curious looking cushion that hadn't said a word was Rowan. And then we came back 2 weeks later. And the guy said, have you got anything funny? And I read out four sketches, no laughs at all. And then Rowan just stood up and did a sketch that I think he'd done earlier, you know, at Newcastle University. And he was, you know, instantly, it was like listening to Adele sing. You know, it was just obvious. He was a genius instantly. And I asked him to tea, as it were.
Rowan has always been really quite a shy bloke, hasn't he? How did you get to be friends?
Yeah, I mean, he's always been very sweet as well as shy. And if you, at that stage, took the trouble to talk to him, he was fun and funny in a kind of gentle way. And I was always far too talkative. So actually, it was quite a good mixture. I'd do 4/5 of the talking and he'd do 1/5 of it. It got worse later when he started to get annoyed by my talking all the time. And I remember having dinner with him a few times and you would just see his hands start to drift towards his ears and he'd put his fingers in his ears whenever I tried to say anything funny.
Would you say you were best mates at that time?
No, I was so lucky. I had a cluster of friends and Rowan was one of those clusters and he moved into a little house where there were. So he was one of my best friends.
And were some of the other best friends people who continued to stay in your life as performers?
Oh, as performers, I mean, Angus Deaton, who was in, maybe he's in the pilot that we're about to do, certainly in one of the shows. He's gone on performing. Helen Atkinson Wood, who was in Blackadder and stuff. So some of them, yeah, absent Tim. Oh, yeah, no, Tim McInerney as well. What am I saying? All of them.
They're all around at that time.
All around, yeah.
And when did you decide to go up to Edinburgh?
We went up to Edinburgh as part of the Oxford show, which was just a less successful version of the Footlight show. And Rowan was extraordinary and it became, you know, a huge success. And then after Not the Nikon News, we went back with Rowan Famous, and that was pretty extraordinary too.
So you've just leapt forward to Not the 9 o'clock News. Did that happen straight out of university?
No, there was a year with nothing much. Oh, no, we did a radio show, I think, called The Atkinson People.
Did you?
Yeah, with Rowan sort of playing four characters.
Owen, have we found The Atkinson People?
We have got the Radio 3, The Atkinson People. It's a belter.
Oh. Yeah, I don't know that it's a belter. I do know that it wasn't enough to, as it were, keep me in food and heating. And so I was just about to join the marketing department of Unilever, as my dad wanted, when the call came from Not the Nikon News. And I, you know, was writing a lot of what Rowan did.
And was that call from John Lloyd?
Probably, yeah. To Rowan. And Rowan probably said, oh, there's this ginger bloke sitting next to me. Could he write a few sketches? There is a theme in my life, which is that the effect of the Pythons. I often say John Cleese is the single most important person in my life, even though I don't know him well, because Not the Nikon News was the type of show it was, newsy, realistic, quite sort of realistic performances and everything, was because Python had been so surreal and big and abstract. We were the sort of anti-Python show, even though we were all huge fans of the Pythons. And then, well, we'll talk about Blackadder's relationship to Fawlty Towers.
You're listening to Tony Robinson's Cunning Cast with me, Tony Robinson. And today, I'm interviewing Blackadder's mastermind and comedy genius, Richard Curtis. Did Not the 9 o'clock News become an overnight success, or was it a grower?
No, it was I think the general agreement was it was going to be cancelled after the first series. And then they did this very clever thing, which was they edited, I think this is true, you know, my memory's very shaky, they edited the first six shows or eight into three best of half hours. And I think they were repeated on BBC One, and the best of half hours were good. And everyone suddenly said, oh, that show's really good, not realizing that, you know, there was 10 good minutes out of every 30 if we were lucky. And so I think it was only in the second series that it became actually a sort of popular hit.
And you also brought Griff Rhys-Jones in for that second
season. That's right, yeah.
So it was quite a good package.
It was, you know, they used to do that a lot, that thing of putting together a bunch of talented people. I think it was a great thing that telly did, is give people, before they got their own huge show and risked everything, as it were, they were allowed to be funny for 5 minutes a week rather than 30 minutes a week.
And yet, time and time again, television pulled four or five talented people together. They had three, maybe four glorious series, and then it all imploded.
Yeah.
Was that the case with Not 9 o'clock News?
Well, I don't know that it... Maybe everybody sort of wanted to go their own ways. I mean, that's just the UK tradition. Once you've got something good, you do it a few times and then move on, rather than, as it were, SNL, where it becomes a sort of incredibly important piece of the sort of financial structure of a broadcaster.
Yeah.
So I think we did kind of fairly well doing four.
So Mel Smith goes, Pamela Stevenson goes, Griff goes.
Yeah.
You and Rowan are clutching each other like drowning men.
Yeah. And then we thought, well, the next natural thing we should do is write a sitcom. And
why was that the natural thing to do?
Well, it sort of was, you know. If you look at, you know, John Cleese had gone from Python to doing Fawlty Towers, Ronnie Barker had gone from the two Ronnies to doing Porridge, you know. It just was the way you thought about things. Radio, sketch TV, sitcom. That was the sort of shape of a comedy career in those days.
Yeah.
And I sat down to try and write a sitcom, and I kind of had an idea, which was that it would be great to do a sitcom with a proper plot. And in other words, something real. I mean, rather than the vicar knocking on the door and there's not enough milk, I thought it would be great to do something with a real plot. And I tried to write a detective sitcom where Rowan was going to be the detective. And then the literal truth was, as whenever I read anything, all I thought is, this is so much worse than Fawlty Towers. Fawlty Towers was like a huge throbbing demon on my shoulder. And then I thought, I just can't write anything set now because it's going to be so pathetic. And then we came up, then there's where the two things met, can't write something set now, won't be as good as 40 Towers. Would love to do something with some plots. And I suddenly thought, God, if we set it in the past, people can die. The plot can be, am I going to have my head cut off? Am I going to be killed?
But it's
and that
a bit...
was a funny Sorry. Idea.
Sorry to interrupt you. I was just getting a bit excited. It's a bit counterintuitive, isn't it? Because the whole thing about a situation comedy is that it's about people trapped in a situation and they're trying to get out of it and they never do. But the thing about plot is that you move on and on and on and on. So you are giving yourself... structurally quite a
well yeah but sitcoms challenge. If you know sitcoms also have guests coming in, new vicar, person opening shop next door, a new neighbor, all that kind of stuff. So as long as it were our characters didn't die, then exciting things could happen. You have the adventures of Robin Hood. So Robin Hood, there'll be a baddie, but there'll also be a friar comes in from here and a maid comes in from there. So I thought you could be like in a castle room and the French Dauphin can turn up and everything like that. So I thought it was okay.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, this is Tony Robinson bringing you my Cunning Cast. If you're enjoying this podcast, please leave a rating or a review. And do take a look at our back catalogue. There's a growing selection of shows there to keep you company. Everything from Census, Coronation, Knights, What the Past Smelt Like, loads and loads. You're going to find something you like, aren't you? Tell me what you remember about the detective series that never happened. What kind of detective... was Rowan, not May Gray.
Literally, can't remember anything. I think he wore an overcoat. Literally, I didn't get very far.
But where you did get to was doing something vaguely medieval.
Yeah, something vaguely medieval, I mean, I came from a time where, if you've been, educated in English school, you knew a lot about the sort of cliches of history and knew a lot about, Shakespeare and how people talked and roughs and everything like that. So I had all sorts of context to do with, and also to do with, ghastly old films about that. I think the reason why, somewhere in the back of my mind, there's a film called The Black Shield of Falmouth, which I
you
think
just
has,
made that.
No, I think Tony Curtis is in it. So there
Falmouth.
Was that feeling. Falmouth, yes. Wasn't a big hit. it was, and whatever that one was called, the Captain Black or something.
But you've also just mentioned Robin Hood. And from the moment that I saw the first script, it struck me that it was very like those half-hour history series. That
William
were going
Tell,
out, that
William Robin Tell, Hood.
Yeah, The Buccaneer,
yes.
Ivanhoe.
Yes, and we watched a lot of those. That's true. That would have been in my mind. It was Robin Hood was hilarious, do you remember? Because they always ended up in the same gap in the woodland. there'd be some riding shots and then a suspiciously similar place which had a tiny bit of water and a very tall tree.
You wrote the pilot in France, didn't you?
Yeah.
Did you say, Rowan, I've got this idea for medieval, come with me to France?
Well, we were probably going away on holiday anyway. And it wasn't a great success insofar as I just... can't co-write with someone in the same room, because just having someone looking at you asking you to be funny is terrifying.
Yeah.
So in the end, like years later when I was doing it with Ben, we would just exchange floppy disks. We'd meet together, talk about how much we love Madness and Kylie Minogue, and then go our separate ways and communicate, as it were, by email, even though email didn't exist. So that was stodgy. And then I think I came home with all the ideas that we had. And then I would have, you know, put them into a, you know, clearer shape.
To me, that French holiday is slightly mythic. Who was there apart from the two of you?
It was dark and depressing. Because Roe's so critical of anything I try and say to be funny. That's why he puts his fingers in his ears when I'm trying to be amusing, because something has to be perfect or it's nothing at all. It's not, oh, there's something there. It's like he can spot when something's right, and something was very rarely very right.
Yes, he doesn't mean to be nasty, does he? Just, it irritates him so much if the smallest thing is slightly wrong.
Yeah,
I can remember we would be in studio together, and like actors, you know, I'm desperately trying to maintain eye contact with him. And I'd always be able to see his eyes flicking up, checking the lights, flicking sideways, checking that the stage manager's doing what stage managers are supposed to be doing, checking what the other actors are doing. And it's not even really that he just wants to rule the world. He just wants stuff to be perfect. Yeah. And it's agony for him when it isn't.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, you know, it used to be much more fun rehearsing Mr. Bean than anything else with Rome, because, as it were, you're looking for physical accuracy and perfection, so you don't have to change the word. Rowan could actually do that himself. Yeah. But you know, we came up with some stuff. I think we came up with a plot or two that we really liked. We, you know, imagined the cast of characters. If he was going to be, I think it became pretty clear that he would be, you know, a second son. There would be therefore a king, a queen, an older brother, and so, you know, that we got all the shapes. I think we thought we were onto something.
Did he do much of the actual writing, or was it more that he knew the kind of direction he thought it should go in?
No, I think we sort of co-wrote the first one. I mean, and then I probably was the person who rewrote it. I imagine that while he was trying on ruffs and cod pieces and fixing the electrics.
So you had this rough script.
Yeah.
You came back to London.
Yeah.
Did you start improving it straight away, or did it go in a drawer?
You know, I literally can't remember. And I do remember John Howard Davis, who I think ended up producing it.
Who was the head of comedy?
Head of comedy.
Who had been Oliver Twist.
Star.
Yeah, it was the David Lee movie.
Was a lovely man. And I remember him saying, there are only two types of sitcom that you can be absolutely certain will fail. And they are sitcoms set in heaven and hell and sitcoms set in history. He said, that's like rock solid. But then he said, well, if that's what you want to do, do it anyway.
Because you must have been in pretty good odour at that time. There weren't many people producing comedy of the quality of Not the 9 o'clock News, were there?
Well, I mean, I don't know about that, but they were definitely the younger generation. And it was definitely, you know, Rowan was clearly a genius, as it were. People weren't going to let him go. He wasn't going to find himself doing Noel Coward and Rep.
So this was an investment in Rowan, just like a few years ago, the BBC invested in Graham Norton and tried different things.
Yeah, or Miranda Hart or Ricky Gervais or something like that, exactly. Yeah.
And it worked out well pretty quickly, didn't it?
Well, or not. Depends how you want to look at it, because we made the pilot and it was, I can't remember much. Of course, I can remember what casting was like in those days.
You say you can't remember much about the pilot. Let me push you on this.
Yes.
So what did the BBC say to you when you showed them the script?
Make it, I imagine they said, cheap-ish. Do you know what I mean? And that was the shock about what happened then in the first series, which was, like, I think, probably the most expensive sitcom ever made. But it was pretty obvious it was a sitcom.
Yeah.
You know, it was set in two rooms and in one bigger room. And things were much more independent then. You were much less watched by executive producers and producers. You know, John was in charge. He actually, you know, was the producer of it. He'd sort of
this said, is John Howard Davis.
John Howard Davis. Yeah. He said, sort of, you know, off you go. Casting was absurd in those days, because there wasn't like a casting department or anything like that in comedy. Nobody really thought. You just cast either your friends or someone you'd seen on TV the night before.
And that's what happened in the pilot.
As far as I sort of remember, Robert Bathurst, I think, lived down the road from my mum. And we'd sort of known him because I think he'd been in the Cambridge Footlights. Tim McInerney was, you know, my closest friend. I think we'd seen John Savident on Coronation Street or something like that. I mean, it really was. And then, you know, someone would chip in. I met this bloke or I met this woman. And there would be your cast. There were no, like, lists.
Alex Norton, he had a big part in it, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. Well, had he been in an episode of Fawlty Towers? I don't know, you know, again.
It would have been sheer luck.
Yeah. Would have been random. Like that you ending up getting cast. Where did you come from?
Well, exactly. I was going to ask you exactly that. I was going to ask you exactly
didn't
that
John
question.
John Howard Davis, hadn't he seen you in something?
He had. Yeah. He had. But I didn't get cast till the Thursday prior to the Monday read-through.
Of the one that eventually got
so
made.
So the question I have never asked you is, who else was up for the part of Baldrick and presumably turned it down?
Literally, I know nothing about any of that.
Are you sure?
I think so.
This isn't deliberate amnesia.
No. Somebody, you know, somebody suggested somebody. It was all much more casual in those days, yeah.
I know that John Howard Davis had seen me in a comedy series. I only was in one episode called Big Jim and the Figaro Club, which was made in BBC Southwest and never even made it national. It was just shown in the Southwest. For some reason, he saw it, wrote me down. He had a book of lists of people that said, I think one page was small and vaguely humorous, and I was on that page.
Yeah.
And he asked me to do it because
very lucky for all of us. I think you give a very good performance as Paul.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Thank you.
When we did that thing the other day for Comic Relief,
yeah,
I was kind of taken aback by the three-dimensionality of it. You know, it's very easy when you think back on things to think, oh, it's a simple thing. He's not very clever.
Yes.
And he looks awful. Yeah. And then I thought, oh, no, because, you know, there's a sort of sorrow in there and there's an innocence in there and there's a sweetness in there and there's a Stockholm syndrome thing going on. And it was a really lucky break for us.
What I remember terribly clearly in the first morning of rehearsals, on the Monday morning after the read-through, and we started to do what actors do, you know, put it on the floor, as they say, I felt I was home. It was extraordinary with you bunch of guys.
That is, I mean, it is odd that, isn't it? Because we, as it were, didn't know you.
No, not at all.
I think it might have been because you were good in the role.
If you'd been bad, you would have been out the door quick.
Hated.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
I'd always wanted to be involved in what I thought of as Oxbridge comedy. Since that was the week that was, you know, that was my generation. I think I was 15 or 16 when That Was the Week That Was came on, which is a bit like you and Monty Python. And it was all so clever and so like me. It was one of those things, all of those shows, it was like, how could they have written that when they don't know me? It's impossible. You'd have to know me to write that. A bit like when I first heard Bob Dylan or Elvis Costello. And I'd written countless letters to the various producers of those shows like Python and all that, never got a sniff.
I'm so glad we were able to help.
Oh, thank you, bless you. And then I came in on that morning and it was just...
We didn't audition you?
No.
Ridiculous.
And I just thought, this is fine, I'm home. But then we rehearsed for 5 days. John Howard Davis comes into the rehearsal room, ashen-faced, says there's a strike at the BBC, it's all off.
Is that right?
Yeah.
But we were rehearsing for the great caboodle of number one.
We were rehearsing for the pilot.
Yeah.
And it disappeared. And I went away. And I got this great job at the National Theatre. So that when they eventually decided to remount the pilot, which I think was a few months later, I wasn't available. Do you not remember any of that? You weren't smoking hemp in those days, were you?
Literally, I never smoked a cigarette. I've never had more than one glass of wine a day.
So you don't remember that the first attempt at the pilot was never even made? Good God.
Who are you? You know, the most important things in life, I've increasingly realized, are things that don't happen rather than things that do. So in other words, the thing that didn't happen is that the original pilot got taken up and became a series. And the thing that did happen is we then did something completely different. You were in it, and therefore we're talking 40 years later. So you must have been thrilled when you didn't hear, when you didn't open your Radio Times to see Blackadder is a new TV series starring Rowan Atkinson and somebody who's not Tony Robinson.
Well, no, because that didn't happen, did it?
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, oh, I see what you mean, yeah. God, in another world, that could have happened, and that would have been fairly horrendous, yeah. When it didn't happen the first time, I was a bit philosophical about it. I thought, I nearly got to this place where I wanted to be, with all these bright young men creating witty, contemporary stuff that's good to act. I nearly got it, and it was taken away from me, but at least I had the experience of those rehearsals.
Yeah.
So it hurt.
Yeah.
But I also felt I had made friends. You and I kept some vague kind of contact. You'd remember nothing about that whatsoever. No. But
well, of course, there weren't telephones in those days. It was only pigeon posts.
That's true.
So it was felt hard like to stay in touch, and I was living in the middle of...
And then I went away and worked at the National. You then pulled together, I suppose, a virtually identical pilot. I can't imagine. Yeah. With virtually the same cast in, I imagine. But now you had Philip Fox rather than I. Can you remember anything about the casting of Philip?
Nope.
Nothing
I
at all.
I remember what he looked like.
You don't remember?
No, I mean, look, I've just watched the pilot.
Yeah.
And it's a very odd thing. It's like different bits of your brain. While I was watching it, I could almost tell you what line was going to come next. It was very sort of deeply ingrained. I was very familiar with the piece of work. But how we got there has disappeared. I mean, my analysis is that I was so traumatized by losing the brilliant young man we'd seen playing Baldrick that I wiped it from my mind. Like, never talk about what happened in the trenches after the war.
Hi, I'm taking time out of this excellent chat to tell you how passionate I am about making these history shows for you, and I think it's pretty obvious from my voice most of the time. So if you are enjoying the series, please do leave us a rating or review, and most importantly, please follow the series so you know when the new episode's dropped. This also helps to boost our place in the podcast charts. It is, as it were, some kind of, I'm searching for the words, cunning plan. And it ultimately means that we can make more and better episodes for you in the future. Thank you. Now we're going.
I remember being pretty pleased with it. I remember thinking it had worked out. I remember... There are lots of things I thought were sweet. I thought it was nicely constructed. It had a punchline at the end. It had a great guest star. I could see the shape of it. And then there was this, Roman and I again were away on holiday together, I think. And five friends came round. And I think videotapes existed. And we had lunch and we said, now we've got an unbelievable treat for you. We're going to show you this, the next thing we're going to do. And it was pretty, pretty good. And we sat down and we watched it. It was literally the underwater world of Jacques Cousteau. Total silence. And it was just amazing because I just thought, oh, never. This is not going to work. This was a failure. I just remember the absolute certainty that screening with that videotape was the end of anything ever called Blackadder, and it was never going to work.
So why wasn't it the end?
Because I think actually there was enough in it, and actually that was just like, maybe everybody was, wanted to go out and swim in a pool or something like that. And we then went back and we looked at it again, and then John Lloyd, with whom we'd done Not the Nicot News, came on board, and we all went back to John and said, look, we think we've got another way of doing it and it could be fantastic, and here's the alternative. And the great Tony Robinson is now free. So let's bring him on board. That was the secret ingredient.
You vaguely knew my name by then, did you?
Yeah.
This is so hurtful.
Yeah. But it was so weird because the pilot is very close to the atmosphere texture and construction of Series 2.
So how did that happen?
Well, it was just so weird. So in many ways, it's kind of, you know, a creative mess, because what happened is we did the first one. Clearly, we all thought it hadn't quite worked.
This is the pilot.
The pilot.
Yeah.
We bring John Lloyd on board. Yeah. We become vaunted with pride, or whatever that term is. We think we can make something really original, on film, huge, actually make it cinematic. We do all of that. And strangely, what really works best in that are the intimate things, is Jim, you know, and Miriam, Jim Broadbent and Miriam sort of sitting there saying funny things to each other. It turns out that the little bits and the dialogue and the sort of almost sketches within the shows are the funniest things. The BBC comes back to us, says it's too expensive, not very popular. And then I bump into Ben Elton, and Ben says, we loved it. We love the theme tune. We think it's pretty funny. But he said, if I was going to do it, you should have set it, just like the pilot, in just a BBC studio with an audience who were laughing at it.
Oh, that was Ben's idea to put
it. It was Ben who was absolutely certain about that. And that was the only way the BBC were going to do it, because they weren't going to pay for an expensive one. So I, at one point in my life, I had two letters from the same man at the BBC saying, dear Richard, we're very sorry, but we are not going to do a second series of Blackadder. And dear Richard, congratulations on the second series of Blackadder winning the BAFTA, from the same guy with the same signature. So it was a strange thing.
Well, we won the BAFTA for the first series.
I think so. I think Rowan kind of, yeah, I feel we did, yeah. Rowe certainly did. Did you get one?
No.
No, supporting actor.
Nobody knew who I was.
Supporting actor, yeah. It's a strange thing that actually the pilot, wrong in many ways, is very close in shape and feel to the second series.
And from my point of view, the Baldrick character in the pilot was a bit stupid. Then he became brighter in the first series.
Exactly.
And then became mega stupid in the second series.
Exactly.
So how did that work?
Well, I think that what we realized in the first series, because it was so epic, I think we kind of lost focus on the sort of theatrical clarity that you kind of need in a sitcom. You know, so because Rome was on a battlefield, and because of the fact that he was in huge halls, and because, you know, he had to ride horses and everything, we lost the sort of unitary nature of his character. And similarly, I think that you were more a co-plotter, weren't you?
Yeah.
And maybe Tim was the stupid one, and we thought you can't have two stupid people, whereas we eventually decided literally everyone except Rowan has to be stupid in order to make it funny. So I think that paring down the production caused us to simplify, and we kind of learned our lesson, which is that in a sitcom, people, as it were, have to be very strong single flavors, and then once they are strong single flavors, then you can open it out. I mean, I, you know, got this sort of feeling about your part that in a strange way, by series four, you actually kind of almost represented the common man. Yeah. The common man. There's something very touching about you, particularly in series four, that, as it were, you are cannon fodder. And I was, you know, I think there's a lot that's moving, but we discovered that, but it had to start off with one simple thought, which is that your brain is made of wood, if it's there at all.
One of the things about series two, which seemed to me so different from all of that angst and wrestling that had gone on before, was the simplicity of the mechanism. It was rather like Hancock, it seemed to me, that you had a bloke who was in this real claustrophobic atmosphere, and he wanted to be great and believed himself to be great, and he was surrounded by idiots, and then he would go out of there to place B, where he still thought he was great, but actually he was surrounded by people who were much cleverer than him or part of a bureaucracy or whatever, and then he falls apart. And it was the tension between those two parts of him and those two worlds which drove the thing along. And really, I think series 2, 3, and 4, that's it, isn't it? That's how it all
works.
Yeah,
and also, I mean, I love sitcom. If I could live for 300 years, I would write, I hope, 2 more, because there is a kind of structural joy to it. I do kind of know how the sitcoms I wrote work, which is the sort of setting up of 2 plots and then interweaving them, the kind of setting up of 2 venues. So, you know, in The Vicar of Dibley, it was her kitchen and the council room. In Blackadder, it was always Blackadder's rooms and then the king or prince's or queen's room. You know, and there's a, you know, that joy in order, that joy in knowing how construction works, or the introduction of a new person who you and Rowan will meet in scene 3, and then they will have an opinion about him in scene 4, and then he'll return in scene 5. So there is a joy about it. And I think we were very distracted by, as it were, location, filming opportunities, size, all of that. And when you pare sitcom down to a kind of rigorous, like writing a sonnet, when you pare it down, you actually produce better work than when you're free. It is interesting that you were cast without question or audition, but Miranda's part in number 2 was like the longest casting process I can remember. We literally saw, it was like sort of Herod. We saw every person, every woman within a certain age range, and then killed their hopes until finally on the last day Miranda walked in and was a mirror.
And you knew straight away that she was right.
Yeah, because she was just so much better than our lines. I mean, that's what you hope for as a writer.
Yeah.
You hope that you've done something that's solid and then someone comes in and suddenly it gains a sort of 3-dimensionality, and you know, you do that and Miranda did it.
I saw that so clearly with Miranda. My story of Miranda is that when she came in on the first day, you could see that she was funny, but it just wasn't quite right. And I remember her and John Lloyd just walking around, prowling around the rehearsal room for the first 2 days. Normally you weren't there very much throughout the week. You'd go away and write the next episode, but for some
reason...
Can I
just say at this point that that's not true?
Oh, that's great.
I was there almost all the time.
Oh, that's...
It was like being... Is it Saint Sebastian who's shot with 1,000 arrows? That's what it was like.
How wonderful. How wonderful. We were talking earlier about the fact that you imagine things in your mind and you think they're true.
Yeah.
I thought you were just away all the time.
No, I just didn't sleep.
I just didn't notice you, mate. I think that's
the thing. Oh, God. Yeah.
You were clearly very worried about that first episode. And we could all see that Miranda was going to be great. And it just, what she knew, it just wasn't quite happening. And I saw these perambulations and it was nearly there. And then suddenly, it was quite fairly late, maybe on the Wednesday, she suddenly did some lines and this character appeared like magic. This girl who was on the cusp of playing with dolls and riding ponies and having fantasies of love, who just happened to be the most powerful person in the world and was a bit sulky in a teenage way. And it all just kind of woof.
But it
went
was
like
so
that.
Original, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That was the point.
Yeah.
I think even when we auditioned her, that was what happened, which is that we thought this performance makes no sense. Whereas everyone else who auditioned was a bit posh, a bit whimsical, a bit public school.
Yeah.
And I think what happened is Miranda was just 14 things. And I think what probably happened there is you said these are the 3, but they were all not what we expected.
It was a wonderful moment. How do you feel about Blackadder now? What kind of emotion runs through your mind if the series is raised?
I mean, I just feel, I think as you get older, you just think, God, what luck, you know. You work on a lot of things and sometimes some of them turn out to be magical. When we made 4 Weddings, I promise you, the day it was released, we thought, if we're lucky, this movie around the world will make £5 million. And then something happened and it became, you know, very successful. And I kind of see that, like, we focused on a bit of work And then the success is a magical piece of luck that sometimes happens. And I think about that with Blackadder.
Yeah.
So I'm, and I, my second thought is, why has it lasted well? And I wonder whether one of the reasons is because it's set in history, it doesn't date.
I think that's absolutely true.
Because it was always dated. So it's like if you watch something from the 19th, even Fawlty's starting to look a bit creaky round the edges. But because of the fact that we were 400 years out of date when we started, I think it has a kind of long-lasting quality. And then I think that the process, which I found so hard, of basically the actors not rehearsing, just simply rewriting and arguing about the script for 5 days a week, did make it very dense. And therefore, I think that it has a richness to it, which means that when people return to it, there's still lots going on, rather than it being very sort of unitary and simple. So I think it's clustered. And I think we caught a lot of people in there performing prime.
I think that's true. It's interesting what you've just said, because as the series went on, more people who were very confident about their own comedy writing skills were drawn into it. And someone like me, who hadn't been confident at all, in fact, I'd been working with you on books in between the series, and I became more confident about my writing skills as well. By series four, you'd got half a dozen people in the room, all of whom thought that they could create the funniest joke in every single scene. And that got to be quite an emotional toll on you, didn't it?
Yeah. No, it was very, very, very... When you spend, you know, when you've written a script and you hope that the actors will rehearse it and you spend 3 hours deciding what the funniest name for a tortoise is, it becomes tricky. And then the other thing is that, you know, scripts are carefully constructed. And when you start to really focus in on something, sometimes when you fix it, there's a terrible price to be paid 3 scenes later. So, you know, as it were, I would say, let's go out to lunch. And then everyone would say, let's go out to dinner at Mrs. Miggins's Muffin Emporium. And then 3 scenes later, there's a lunch scene, but because we've changed it to dinner at the Muffin Emporium,
we've got to rewrite that
whole scene.
Yeah.
And no one's going to give way on that 3 hours of work that they put into the Muffin Emporium. But there was certainly one or two occasions when enthusiasm got the better of you. I think the poets, I feel, were.
What were the poets?
The poets entered in some series, a whole cluster of...
A whole club, Byron and Shelley and those people. Yes, that was in series three, wasn't it? Yeah. Is it fair to say that we couldn't have made any more series because people were too cross with each other by the end of the fourth series?
Yeah, well, I don't know. That's an interesting question. There's also a thing which happens in, I think, in something iterative like Blackadder, where the danger is that you start to write what's in the formula rather than what you yourself find funny. The only rule in writing comedy is you've got to find it funny yourself. The single thing I remember in my first 10 years is not liking it when people said people think British Rail sandwiches are funny, trade unions, so-and-so. You know, either you find it funny and write it or don't do it. And the danger is that, as it were, we got to the point where we thought, 4 times Rowan has to say you are as stupid as, and then you have to do that, and you know this is the characteristic of that person, and we've got to start introducing, you know, the Duke of Wellington or Raleigh or so the strictures of what's been amusing starts to close in on you, and you realize you're writing to someone else's instructions, possibly to your instructions from 2 years ago, but it stops being, and then everybody can say, oh, it worked last time we did that. Yeah. So that's the experience in the room. So it starts getting encrusted. It stops being a living thing and starts being a mechanical thing. And I think Ben and I have felt that coming. You know, he would say to me, shouldn't we do this kind of a thing? We did that kind of a thing in that series. Should there be a love element in this one, whether or not we find it funny? So I think it was a mixture between it being a very tough creative process, but also the process start, the joints of the comedy starting to be less natural and more, you know, planned.
There's a bit of me that thinks it's a shame that we didn't do another series. There's a lot of me that is glad because I don't think we would have been able to make it as well. But at its best, the high points, both the camaraderie, the mutual appreciation around the rehearsal room, and a lot of the gags were so wonderful.
No, look, I had it was very sweet. I don't know why. Maybe it was relating to the fact we're talking to each other. My son sat me down yesterday and made me watch four bits of the Blackadder Series 3 election. Pitt the Younger coming in, and then one scene where you've got a
turnip in my
mouth. Turnip in your mouth.
Yeah.
Everything like that. And that was kind of lovely, your son saying to you, this stuff is funny, because on the whole, my son can't be bothered to watch things that I'm making. So, yeah. And we had the idea for doing the one in the 60s, which I think would have been quite funny. I was quite keen on that. But
this is Rowan as Queen Elizabeth's bastard son lurking in Buckpal.
Well, I don't know. It was mainly you being a drummer called Bald Rick. That was basically the only joke I had. But also Bald Rick killing President Kennedy. It was this idea of the fact that we might actually be able to use modern history, possibly even archive footage, that we would sort of explain the 60s.
Zelig.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I think that might have been quite funny.
The one person we haven't talked about who made, I think, a profound contribution to the series is Howard Goodall.
Howard Goodall's music was like a magical seduction into, so the moment it started, a lot of great sitcom themes have done this. They bring you in to the world. And then it was fun, and he redid it for every series. And then, of course, the final use of the tune at the end of Blackadder 4 was, you know, very, very moving, etc. That was all part of, you know, the strangeness of the fact that, you know, a lot of people who were involved had been friends at 20. And I do think that's one of the things also about comedy. I've always said about my writing that all I'm trying to be is half as funny as my best friends are two drinks down at 10 o'clock in the evening. And one of the things about clusters of friends doing, and I'm so glad you felt part of it, doing comedy, is you're actually reproducing the joys, in-jokes, silliness, fun, and imagination of friendship. So, you know, there is the sort of argument about nepotism, but we already knew why Rowan was funny, why Tim was funny, Howard and his music understood us. Ben's relationship with Rick meant that Rick was allowed to come in and just be anarchic and amongst friends and everything. So the kind of friendship element is, you know, was part of the magic of it.
And you all knew that the funniest name of a fish is halibut and that the funniest vegetable is a turnip.
I mean, I suppose the final thing I would say about the pilot is I think it's better than I thought it would be, and quite an interesting historical document. I think there are some lovely performances by people who we didn't see again. I would say I was pleasantly surprised and strangely familiar with a piece of work about which I have no memories at all.
Go on, you be Edmund, because you start with one of the finest lines you've ever written.
The eunuchs have cancelled.
Oh, dear.
I should have known. Never trust a eunuch.
And then Percy says, what are we going to do? The Queen will be most disappointed.
Well, I know what I'm going to do. Give me that execution order.
That was originally pass me that execution order, wasn't it?
Oh, that makes all the difference.
It does.
Honestly, I cannot believe that this script exists.
Yes.
I remember chiseling it on stone. That was the way that we wrote it.
Certainly,
the computer
days,
hadn't been invented when we wrote this.
Have a look at page 28.
Okay, what happens on page 28? Oh, my Lord. Perhaps you're right. We need something more cunning. Page 29, look.
Oh.
And then, Baldrick says,
I say, I have a cunning plan. Although I didn't say it quite like that.
How about that? I'm so thrilled. because Ben and I never knew who wrote what, I'm not sure I remembered that I would have written I Have a Cunning Plan. But of course, it was there in the first series. It was there in the pilot.
You see, I didn't know that because I haven't looked at this forever and ever. It's not until round about, would you believe it or not, series three that I start saying it regularly.
Yeah.
And other people, you wrote that line for other people in series two.
Really?
Rowan said it once, Percy, I think he was
in it. Yeah, you've got your honesty. You're so lucky to have a catchphrase.
I knew when I first saw it.
Well, I Have a Cunning Plan.
I knew that.
Well, that's a historic document. I Have a Cunning Plan, BA, although it's slightly confusing.
Oh, God, let's read that whole page. It is actually very funny.
Where is it?
Page 30. I Have a Cunning Plan, I say.
And then Rowan says, yes, perhaps I think I have a more cunning one.
And I say, mine's pretty cunning, my lord.
Yes, but not cunning enough, I imagine.
And then I say, beat, beat, beat. Well, it depends how cunning you mean, sir.
And then Rowan says, well, I mean pretty damn cunning. How cunning do you think I mean?
Mine's quite cunning, my lord.
Oh, no, my kids always say my only joke is repetition. And not, they're right. All right, then let's hear it. Let's hear what's so damn cunning.
And then I say, well, my lord, first you ask him to come with you.
Oh, yes, very cunning, brilliantly cunning. I ask him to come with me and then stab him, perhaps. How cunning can you get? So that's the word cunning. I mean, we were pushing. We were trying to make it a catchphrase by having the word cunning. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 times. One page.
Our viewers will just have had a masterclass in writing from one of Hollywood's finest writers. You say the same word 13 times.
I know. There we go.
Thanks for listening. If you want to watch the documentary Blackadder the Lost Pilot, it's available to catch up on Sky, Virgin and Now. If you want to join in the conversation, you can find me on X at Tony Robinson, and you can follow all our podcast news on X and Instagram at CunningCastPod. And please don't forget to follow this podcast so you don't miss a single episode. I'm Tony Robinson. This is my Cunning Cast, produced by Melissa Fitzgerald, and it's a Zinc Media production.